it's always good to be with other family. It's always my privilege, and it's always a blessing for me to be here with you. And I hope that when we're all said and done today, that you'll be blessed as well. I want to go over to Joshua, just read something for just a moment in Joshua chapter 11. No, Tammy and I did not confer. In fact, I've been telling Sandra over there, I'm really needing to kind of get this together in my mind, what I'm going to talk about. So, and it is, usually the way it works when I'm here. He starts speaking to me about the time I sit down over in that chair as to what I want to share. So before I read something here, Joshua chapter 11, as I was just sitting there thinking, you know, Father, what, you know, I want you to lead and guide me here. I thought of something I had not thought of in years and years and years. When I was probably 19, 20, 21 years old, somewhere in that neighborhood, before Beth and I were married, I don't remember if we were dating at the time or not, I was working in a paint company, and I had been there a couple of years, and I'd worked real hard. And the gentleman I worked for, he made me his assistant manager. I was doing pretty well. But being the assistant manager meant you had to be there on Saturdays. Now, at the time, I didn't know anything about Shabbat or anything like that. I just knew that I was a young buck, and I didn't want to be there on a Saturday, to be honest with you. But that was part of my job. And I remember one Saturday, I went in, and the crew was there, and everything was kind of slow. And so about midday, I thought, well, I'll just go home. They got it all under control. And so I did. And the next Monday, I found out that my boss found out and had gone in and worked the rest of that Saturday in my stead. And that, absolutely, to know that I had disappointed him, broke my heart. And I went in, and he just shared with me how disappointed he was that, you know, he thought I was going to be more responsible than that. And to be honest with you, I thought I was going to be more responsible than that too. But I just kind of let what I wanted to do get in the way. Now, here's why I'm sharing this. I can't even begin to convey to you what that made me feel like, to know that I had disappointed this person who had put such effort and energy and time investing in me and my life and trying to help me, and then to know that I had disappointed him like that. But I promised him that will never happen again. And as far as I know, by the time he passed away, I never did anything like that again. And he was one of those people that God put in my life to teach me some things that I'll remember for the rest of my life. So that brings me to what I wanted to start out with here in Joshua chapter 11 in verse 15. As the Lord had commanded Moses, his servant, so Moses commanded Joshua, and so Joshua did. He left nothing undone of all that the Lord had commanded Moses. And so that's where I want to start. Here's a man that did everything that was expected of him and didn't leave anything undone. And if you think about it, most of what he had to do that had been commanded to Moses and then passed along to him was to fight. To fight. As Tammy shared, to have courage. And I would suggest to you that there are few people today in the body that truly display courage to do what needs to be done today. Because a lot of people in the body have been discouraged by whatever is going on around them, by family, by other people in the body. And one of the things that stands out to me about the report of the spies, the evil report of the 10 spies, was the people said, our brethren have discouraged our hearts. Which is to say, our brethren have taken our courage away. Because when you discourage someone, that's what you're doing. You're taking their courage away. Which then means this. They cannot encourage somebody. Because if you're going to encourage somebody, you have to possess the courage in the first place. So Joshua is an example of someone who had courage. He By his actions, I would say, he encouraged others to have courage, to follow him, and to do these things that they were commanded to do. And he left nothing undone which had been given him to do. So, when I read that several years ago, and I thought on that, I thought, what must it be like to go into eternity knowing that of all the things that God has given you to do, there's not one thing you left undone? What must it be like, or what will it be like, maybe that's the best way to put it, to stand before the Creator and hear him say, well done, good and faithful servant. You didn't leave one thing undone that I gave you to do. That's my goal. That's what I want to strive for. And it's not for notoriety. It's not for, you know, this, that, or the other. It's just to know that what he put me on this planet to do, to play my role, for you to play your role, whatever that may be, that when we stand before him, to know that we did what we were supposed to do here, that we ceased to exist more or less, so that it was no longer I who lives, but it's Messiah who lives in me, who works through me to accomplish his purposes in this world. And so we go about our lives and we have our routines, we have our vocations, we have those things that we have to attend to. But in some way, somehow, if we're listening to his voice, if we're trying to walk out our lives according to his word, as he gives us the light by his Torah, by his instructions, somehow, some way, he's prepping us, he's preparing us, he is equipping us to step into that which he created us to be and to do in this world. Most of us, the world will never know our name, but that doesn't matter. What matters is that when we stand before him, we can hear him say, well done, good and faithful servant. So going back to Joshua, what that meant was that God called him to fight, and he fought. He waged war. He overcame strongholds. He overcame adversaries. They were not deterred by the giants. They were not deterred by the fortified cities, because they had been encouraged. They possessed the courage that God gave them to know that if they would do what he called them to do, that God's already fought the battle. It's just, at this point, who actually believes that I've gone before you? Who actually believes that I will do what I said I will do? My take, as far as the Hanukkah story, has nothing to do with latkes or gelt or dreidels, or even the legend of miraculous oil. My take on Hanukkah is this, that if you're going to rededicate a temple, you have to be dedicated to follow the steps that the Creator has set before you. And it doesn't happen overnight. The true miracle of Hanukkah is actually a process that at least spanned a few years, where people who, like it was said this morning, who took farming implements, farming tools, and whatever they could get their hands on, because at some point they had their Popeye moment. You know what I mean?
I've had all I can stands, and I can't stands no more.
The progressives of their day, the godless of their day, the tyrants of their day, said, you can't say this, you can't do that. We're going to tell you what you can do. We're going to tell you what you can't do. We're going to put you over there in a corner. And finally, someone stood up and said, that's enough. That's enough. And they made the decision to fight. I mean, if you think about it, most everything the Creator has called us to do requires that we fight. Whether it's against the adversary without or the adversary within, it requires for us to be of good courage, to know the Lord has already won the battle for us, but be willing to fight. And I just think that we have a body today, as was just presented to us in the song, the words of a song, that we have a body today that is anemic, it's lethargic, it's not willing to fight. And so if Hanukkah means anything to me, it means this, that there comes a season when the Creator allows for things to happen that creates an environment that is going to produce those who are willing to stand up and say, that's it, I've had enough, I've got to fight. I've got to possess the courage. Another way to put that is this. The story of Hanukkah boils down to, at least in my mind, a group of people who were posed with this question: who are you more willing to offend? The Greeks or the Almighty? Who are you more willing to offend? These people that are confronting you and trying to tell you what you can do and how you can live and what you can say? Are you okay with offending him to make allowance for them? Or are you prepared to offend them, knowing if you offend them, you better get ready for a fight? That's where we're at right now. So for me, today anyway, that's the story of Hanukkah. Who am I more willing to offend, them or him? And I don't want to stand before him having left things undone. I don't want to stand before him and have to hear that I didn't fulfill my purpose, that you didn't fulfill your purpose. Because when the call comes, and it will, when the call comes for us to fulfill our purpose, it might not be that we step into some grand palatial environment that everybody is bowing down to us and saying how great and wonderful there. It may not be that at all. It probably won't be, frankly. When the call comes, it might be to pick up the sword and say, that's far enough. It's time we fight. Now, I realize that we don't fight against flesh and blood, and I realize that our warfare is not carnal. I get that. We're fighting against principalities and these powers who work through flesh and blood, who work in and through people, just like the Spirit of God works in his people and moves and operates within his body. That's how the adversary works too. So again, I understand our enemy is not flesh and blood, but our enemy works through flesh and blood. And by the way, there's a lot of that flesh and blood that he works in right now that's trying to tell me what I can do, what I can't do, what I can say. No, you need to be quiet about all these things you believe in, because see, that's offensive to us. Again, who am I more willing to offend? Him or them? And I'm just at the place, I'm okay with offending them. I'm okay with offending them. That's not what I set out to do. But I'm okay with it now because the battle lines are drawn. I know that last time when I was here, I don't remember all of the things that we talked about, but I do remember talking about the fact that from the beginning, the Creator of the universe, who can do anything he wants, when he wants, how he wants, chose to work through people just like you and me. Do you remember we talked about how when David went out to meet Goliath, how it's a picture of the Messiah going to bring an end to the exile? And if you weren't here, I don't know what to tell you. Get the tape or something. But that David is a picture of the Messiah, and he's going out to break the hold that the nations have upon his people, upon Israel. But when he goes out to take down Goliath, emblematic of the nations, what did he use to do it? A stone. That stone is emblematic of you and me. We come to him as to a living stone because we are living stones being built up into a spiritual house. And so just as he gathers stones to build his spiritual house, David gathered stones and he took one of those stones and he put it in his sling. And even though David is the one who brought the giant down, he used a stone. In other words, even though the Messiah is bringing forth restoration, even though the Messiah is bringing about his purposes in the earth today, how does he choose to do it? Through people like you and like me. Imperfect people like you and me. People who fail him continually. People who are faithless continually. People who are all the time wanting to do what's good in their own eyes. People who are wanting to satisfy their own lusts and their own desires. And in spite of us, he still chooses to use us to fight, to stand, to take away from the kingdom of darkness, to advance his purposes in the earth. So again, you think about those people that fought in that war. It had been a long time coming. Things didn't just happen overnight. This was something that had been a long time coming. And the Creator's observing all of this. He's allowing it to happen. Maybe in some situations, he's even orchestrating events. But it's going to put people in a situation where they're going to have to make a choice. They're going to have to make a decision. Am I going to lay down or am I going to fight? Do I possess the courage to look them in the eye and say no? Do I possess the courage to look at the enemies of our Father and say, I'm not going to concede to your wishes. I'm not going to bow down to your gods. I'm not going to bow down to your whims. From the very beginning, the Creator establishes boundaries. I don't recall if we talked about this last time, but if I'm repeating myself, you'll just have to forgive me. And remember, the Messiah would often say, and again, I say unto you. All right? I've shared that joke a few times here too. Anyway, from the very beginning, the Creator established boundaries. When he said, let there be light, he distinguished that light from the darkness. He distinguished the day from night. He set a boundary, if you will. He set a border. When he established the firmament to divide the waters above from the waters below, it was so that the waters above would not mingle with the waters below. The firmament established a boundary, a border, if you will. When he gathered the seas together under one place so that dry land could appear, according to Job, he then says to the seas, you can come this far, but you can't cross this boundary. He established borders. He established boundaries. Later on, when he plants a garden in Eden toward the east, that garden had boundaries. It had borders. In fact, Eden, loosely translated as paradise, which comes from a Persian word that means an enclosed space. A place that had borders and boundaries. And then he took that man that he formed from the dust of the earth, he appointed him, placed him, but appointed him to be there in that garden to tend it, to till it, to work it, to do everything that was necessary for that garden to function according to his design and his purpose. But he also told him, you got to keep it. Which is to say, you've got to guard it. You've got to defend it. And if you're going to defend it, that means there's somebody out there that wants to penetrate, that wants to get in. The tares are not satisfied by just hanging out in the field of tares. That enemy who is aggressive by nature, who is unrelenting, who is always trying to find a weak point to exploit so that he can sow tares in the midst of the wheat, that's the enemy that we've got to guard against. That's the one that we have to be defending, that which has been entrusted to us by the Creator, against whatever it is the adversary wants to do. And if we're going to defend, sometimes that means we're going to have to be willing to fight. Because the adversary is. That's what Genesis 3:15 is all about. We are in a state of war between the serpent and his seed. And that war goes on until he is finally and for all time vanquished and put in a pit of fire. And so until that day comes, you and I, under the kingship of the Messiah, the captain of the Lord's host, we're supposed to be fighting. We're supposed to be defending that which he's entrusted to us. And by the way, those men that were sleeping in that field of wheat, why were men in that field in the first place? Why weren't they at home in bed? Why were they there? They were supposed to be guarding it. They were supposed to be defending it. But they went to sleep. They were overcome. They became lethargic. They became apathetic. And that's exactly what the adversary counts on, so that he can exploit our laziness, our apathy, our disinterest. By the way, I suggest to you that field of wheat had borders. It had boundaries. They were supposed to be defending it. Again, if we're going to defend something, that means we have to fight for it. That means we have to be willing to fight for it. All right, so I think some of you probably can guess where I might be going with this. Probably going to fool you, though. Because all the things that are happening in the political world and people marching to assault borders and to overrun border patrol and all these things, I'm going to suggest to you that is merely a physical manifestation of something that's going on spiritually. Because the spiritual mindset is borderless, no boundaries. It's not just political. Political is a manifestation of what's really going on in the world, because our world has become borderless, respecting no boundaries. And by that I mean God's boundaries, His borders, those things that He says, this is holy, this is not, this is clean, this is unclean. We live in a world where the godless don't want to regard those boundaries. That's what the Greeks were doing a couple of millennia ago. They were telling God's people, we don't respect your God's boundaries. To the contrary, you need to respect the boundaries that we're establishing, which is we're going to erase all of yours. Let me do this. Let's go to 2 Thessalonians. Well, if I can get my fingers to work, I'll get over there. All right, 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Verse 1. Now, brethren, concerning the coming of our Lord Yeshua the Messiah, and our gathering together to Him, we ask you not to be soon shaken in mind or troubled, either by spirit or by word or by letter, as if from us, as though the day of Messiah had come. Let no one deceive you by any means, for that day will not come unless the falling away comes first, and the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition, who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he sits as God in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. If I can put it this way, the son of perdition has no respect for God's boundaries. Okay? Do you not remember that when I was still with you, I told you these things? And now you know what is restraining, that he may be revealed in his own time. For the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. Only he who now restrains will do so until he is taken out of the way. And then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will consume with the breath of his mouth and destroy with the brightness of his coming. The coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan, with all power, signs, and lying wonders, and with all unrighteous deception among those who perish because they did not receive the love of the truth that they might be saved. And so for this reason, God will send them strong delusion that they should believe the lie, that they all may be condemned who did not believe the truth but had pleasure in unrighteousness. I want to summarize that and say this. That the lawless one, the son of perdition, the Antichrist, whatever you want to call him, he doesn't just pop up overnight in the sense that all of a sudden the world becomes lawless and he's on the world stage. No, he steps into an environment that has already been cultivated by the people of the world. And because the people of the world in this day and time that's being described for us are lawless, they're to the point of they would rather embrace the lie, reject the truth. And so God says, okay, if you want the lie, that's what you'll have. And you'll end up believing a lie to be the truth. It's like if you want quail bad enough, God gives it to you. If you want a king bad enough to be like everybody else, He'll give you that. And if you want to reject the truth and embrace a lie bad enough, if you want to harden your heart continually, against his truth, against his word, against his purposes, eventually he'll harden your heart for you and you'll end up believing a lie is the truth. That is the scenario into which this son of perdition walks into. But lawlessness, I'm sure that a lot of you know the Greek term is anomia. Nomia is the Greek equivalent of the Hebrew Torah. And so what we're really describing here is, or what Paul's describing, is a time of people who do not want to respect and regard his instructions, his Torah, which I will suggest to you is his boundaries for how you and I are supposed to live. It marks this border to the left and it marks the border to the right. And as long as I stay within the borders of his word, I'm on a path that takes me to life and to blessing. And that's why we're told, don't turn to the right, don't turn to the left. Don't go beyond those borders and boundaries. Respect them. Do the work that you're supposed to be doing within those boundaries, within those borders, but also defend them, keep them, guard them, because there's an adversary out there who is going to be unrelenting in his attempt to get you to compromise over here or to compromise over there. And that is lawlessness. When God created mankind, he created them male and female. Two. Only two. One or the other. But we now live in a world that does not recognize those borders. In fact, are crafting laws that are biblically lawless. When God instituted marriage, a man was supposed to leave his father and mother, cleave unto his wife, so that the two become one flesh. But we now live in a world where the law says that two of the same can be equivalent to what God established. In other words, there are laws, but the laws are lawless. They do not recognize the boundaries and the borders that the Creator has established. And we could go on and on and on and on. And so this little thing that's going down on the southern border, where people are coming up and not respecting the borders and boundaries and defying laws, that's just one manifestation of a mindset that's sweeping over the planet. Lawlessness. Here's where I'm going with this. We're already at a place that Paul described. We're already there. In fact, when it says in verse 12 that they had pleasure in unrighteousness, literally translated, pleasure in unrighteousness would be to look favorably upon injustice. To look favorably on injustice. Now, biblically speaking, if someone is accused of something, before we can render a judgment, there have to be at least two of something. Right? Had two or more witnesses. They have to corroborate. They have to support one another. They have to be telling the same story. And if they bring corroborating evidence, then we're in a position to render a judgment. Now, let's say that we only had one witness. There's only one witness bringing an accusation forth. Can we render judgment, biblically speaking? But if we did anyway, what would that be? Injustice. One witness. Everybody else is saying something different. One witness says one thing, and we render judgment anyway. That would be injustice. So let's say you have a judge who's up to go on the Supreme Court. One person's making an accusation. Everybody else is saying something different, and yet the world is ready to pass judgment anyhow. What's that called? And would it be fair to say that there are people who look favorably upon that injustice? By the way, the Hebrew word kavanah means intent of the heart. So through all of that, here's what the Creator was doing as far as I'm concerned. He was putting our hearts on display. He was showing the world what's really in our heart. And you know why all that was happening? It's because there are very few people who are willing to sometimes God raises up people that to believers, they look like a bunch of heathens. And yet somehow or another, they have the will to fight. Maybe he's trying to tell us, if I can get people who you think are heathens to fight, why can't I get you to do it? Where are my people that are demonstrating courage and the will to fight and to stand for what is right? Because the reason that we're in this mess, the reason those Maccabees had to fight, is because generations before, no one did. Do you know why God had to put cherubim there to guard the way to the tree of life? Because Adam didn't. And so we are now in the place that you and I believe with my whole heart, are being called upon to fight. Why? Well, because generations before, other people went to sleep. And we just kind of went along with it. And now we're in a season. You ever notice that Hanukkah comes in the darkest time of the year? In other words, the time to rise up, to say enough is enough, to take up the sword, so to speak, and to fight against those godless, borderless, those who would not regard the Creator's laws and instructions, the time to rise up and do that and dedicate ourselves to the fight, to know that He is with us and He is for us. And if we will overcome, if we will persist, if we will continue to defend those things that He's entrusted to us, then we have a promise that we can rededicate His house to the glory of God. We can become that light that was mentioned earlier. I feel like I'm going all over the place here. Hopefully not, but remember when, Jacob is in Syria for 20 years, and the man who a lot of theologians accuse of being a cheater, a supplanter, and a deceiver for 20 years was cheated, supplanted, and deceived. Laban was always cheating him, always changing his wages, always trying to squeeze a little bit more at him, hold on to him. He's not wanting him to go back to Canaan. He's wanting to keep him for his own personal slave because he's making him rich. So he's continually abusing Jacob, falsely accusing Jacob. And these are things that the Creator allowed to happen. But when it came time for him to go back to the land, he steals away. And the Bible tells us that Laban hears of this and finally overtakes him, goes looking through the camp. You've stolen my gods. You've taken this. And it culminates with these two men coming to an agreement. And they took stones, it says. Jacob said to his brethren, gather stones. And so they took stones and they piled them up in a heap. And the Hebrew word would be gal. Because these stones were going to be a witness between us. I won't pass over this border to you to do you harm. You don't pass over this border to do harm to me. And so Galid or Gilead became a term that is associated with a heap or a gathering of witnesses. But what were those witnesses? Stones. So those stones were to be a witness of things, but they were also to establish a border, a boundary. Here's where I'm going with this. You and I, when we defend these boundaries and borders that the Creator has entrusted to us, not only does that mean we're fighting, it means we're witnessing. How are the people going to know unless someone's sent? How are they going to know what's light if the light is being hidden under the bed? How are they going to know what's clean and unclean, what's holy and profane, unless there is someone who was willing to walk in that lifestyle, to defend it, and to be a witness to those who are out here groping in the darkness? And so the fight is not just to get the best of them. The fight is to get them to come around to being what God has called them to be, what God desires them to be. It's not about vanquishing our enemies as much as it is being a light to our enemies in the hope that one day those that want to destroy us, want to kill us, want to abuse us can be changed. I mean, you think about Nebuchadnezzar, all he did, destroyed Jerusalem, destroyed the temple, carted off Daniel and all these other guys into captivity, and ends up saying, you know, Daniel, your God is God. How did that happen? Because somebody was willing to be at their post defending those boundaries that God had established. They purposed in their heart that they would not eat the king's delicacies or drink his wine. In the midst of all that was going on, they purposed in their heart they would defend this that God had entrusted to them. And that became a witness to those who were in darkness. Again, if I'm repeating myself from last time, please forgive me, but I'm just kind of go with the flow. 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 1. I charge you therefore before God and the Lord Yeshua the Messiah, who will judge the living and the dead at his appearing and his kingdom. Preach the word. I want to stop right there and make this observation. If you're going to preach the word, you have to know the word. I say that because a lot of theology is being preached. But how much of the word is being preached? May I recommend to you that the time has come, the season is upon us, when the call is going forth for people who will actually preach, teach, live, declare the word of the Lord, not the theology of men. We don't need more theologians, with all due respect to theologians. But the study of God, that's what theology is, does not necessarily equate to the word of God. And so Timothy was being charged to preach the truth. Tell people the truth. Who are you more willing to offend, him or them? And if you're going to regard his borders and his boundaries, if you're going to respect his position and his authority, then guess what? You're going to have to offend men. Preach the word. Be ready in season and out of season. Convince, rebuke, exhort with all longsuffering and teaching. Here's why. For the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but according to their own desires, because they have itching ears, they will heap up for themselves teachers, and they will turn away their ears from the truth and be turned aside to fables, to myths. But you be watchful in all things. What does being watchful mean? Be on guard. And when you see something that is going to pollute or contaminate or try to undermine that which has been entrusted to you, being watchful for these things means that you're going to have to be willing to fight for these things. Anything worth having is worth fighting for. How many times have I heard that through my life? And it's still true. And the most important thing that we have been has been set before us are the things that pertain to the kingdom of heaven. And it is our duty to fight for those things. So he said, you be watchful in all things, endure afflictions, do the work of an evangelist, and fulfill your ministry. Which says to me, if I were going to insert myself into this, the Creator through this man is saying, Bill, you've got to be on guard, you've got to be watchful, and you've got to be willing to fight for these things. And while you're fighting, no, it's not going to always be easy. You're going to have to endure a lot of stuff. You're going to have to endure accusations, because Jacob had to endure accusations. You're going to have to endure afflictions, because all the forefathers had to endure afflictions. You're going to have to be cheated, lied about, abused, accused, and all these things. And all the while, the Creator just sitting back watching, seeing, are you going to have the courage to fight in spite of all these things? So all these things are necessary if we are going to fulfill our purpose for being here. Remember, Joshua didn't leave anything undone that had been commanded him to do. And most of his life was spent either wandering through the wilderness, enduring all of that, or fighting for those things that God had granted and entrusted to his people. When the Maccabees, according to the story of Hanukkah, when they took up the sword and said, enough's enough, it was 3 years before they dedicated the temple. Didn't happen overnight. So you know what happened in that 3 years, right? Fighting. They're in a state of war. But they continued. They endured the afflictions that go along with that. And they overcame a far superior force. But that's kind of God's way, isn't it? We look at an enemy that looks insurmountable. You know, we can't defeat this. We can't overcome this. And he takes the most unqualified, seemingly. He takes those that you think, what in the world was he thinking? But if those people have the courage to go forward and fight, look at what he accomplishes in them and through them. And for them. Let's go back over to Genesis for a second. Yeah, Mark's reminding me here just about all of those people, those different groups out in the world today that are trying to advance unholy things, they fight tooth and nail. I mean, they're ready to fight. They have been. In fact, that's why we're in the situation we're in, because they've been willing to fight and we haven't. In Genesis chapter 41, this actually begins the Torah portion called Miketz, which I would assume that a lot of you know this is the Torah portion this week. So it's always just amazed me that the Torah portion called Miketz, which is about Joseph in prison, these kinds of things, coincides with Hanukkah. Miketz means at the end. Now, to me, that screams, if you're living at the end of days, you better perk up and take note of what's going on here. And what has led us to this point? Well, there was a lot of family infighting. There was a lot of jealousy and a lot of envy and probably lack of wisdom and discretion on the part of some others. And it's led to this big family bust up. By the way, the story of Hanukkah also tells us that the initial conflict was not between Jews and Greeks, but was between Jews and Jews. Between those who said enough is enough and those who were just willing to lay down and to conform to the whims of the Greeks and those who wished to have them assimilate into their culture. But anyway, you know, Joseph finds himself in prison and he's been falsely accused, you know the story. And not in this Torah portion, but in the previous one, he had actually interpreted the dreams of the cupbearer. And the cupbearer, of course, went back to Pharaoh's house. You remember? Now, I can't help but think that when he interpreted that dream and the cupbearer is summoned to go back to Pharaoh's house, I can't help but think that Joseph is thinking, okay, I'm getting out of here. But it didn't happen that way. 2 full years went by. 2 full years of after Joseph thinking, well, this is going to happen. I'm going to get out of here. This is my ticket out. And it didn't happen the way he thought. And he had to continue to endure the affliction of being in the prison. But after 2 years, it says, it came to pass that Pharaoh had a dream, and behold, he stood by the river. And I'm not going to read all of the dream here. He has the 2 dreams, which in reality are 1 dream. But here's what I want to focus on. Joseph had been through a lot, but as far as we know, Joseph had always remained at his post. whatever situation Joseph found himself in, he ends up ruling. He ends up doing what he's gifted to do, what he's ordained to do. The environment didn't change his purpose. It just changed, you know, the setting. But my point is that from everything we can read, whatever he had to endure, he still remained at his post, so to speak. He was still guarding that which had been entrusted to him. So who's observing all this? The Creator is. Is this man going to be faithful in all situations? So for 2 years, he remained at his post, if I can put it that way, and probably went to bed one night never thinking that on this night, God's going to give the most powerful man on the face of the earth a dream that he can't interpret. In other words, Joseph didn't know it was coming. He just knew what God had told him years before. He just knew what God had put in his heart a long time before. But he went to bed one night not realizing that the next morning his world was about to change. And all the things that God had been doing in his life, doing through his life, all the things that he's had to endure, all the things that he's had to overcome, all the hurt, all the pain, all the tears, all the joy, everything that he'd gone through was about to come to fruition. In some ways, anyhow. The next day, his world was going to change. Because when the Pharaoh wakes up and he's had these dreams and he's troubled and he goes to those people that he's counted on to give him instruction and advice, nobody can help him. And all of a sudden the cupbearer remembers, you know, there is this guy. God always has his man. He always has his woman in that place. Anyway, the call came. And he was prepared. And he went in and he appeared before the king and he ends up being the viceroy of all Egypt. If you go and read the book of Daniel, 2 years into Nebuchadnezzar's reign, interestingly enough, he had dreams. And he, like Pharaoh before him, was unable to interpret those dreams. And so he goes to the people that he's always called upon to interpret these things. They can't help him. And so, well, there's this guy who just happens to be there. All right? Do you think Joseph, if he could have picked the place where God found him in that, or where Pharaoh found him, do you think that Joseph would have picked the prison? Do you think that's the place that he would have liked to have been? No. If Daniel could have had it his way, do you think that he would have preferred to be in Babylon or would he would rather be back home in Jerusalem? But God had them exactly where he needed them to be. And they were faithful to stay at their post and defend and guard those things that had been entrusted to them. And after a while, when all these components came together at just the right time, he already had the right man, in some cases the right woman, Esther, just where they were supposed to be. But each and every one of them, think about it, they had to have the courage. Joseph has got to have the courage to go listen to this dream and then say, God's going to give you an answer of peace. And he went on beyond interpreting the dream to telling the king, here's what you need to do. So you think about that. I'm going to tell the king, for 7 years you're going to have prosperity, and then it's going to be followed by 7 years of lack, and this is why you need to do this during the years of prosperity. Don't you know, at least if Bill had been there, he'd been thinking, okay, Lord, we need some prosperity for about 7 years now. That took courage. That took confidence. That took the relationship to know that God was orchestrating events to step into that and to do what you've been called upon to do. Daniel goes to the Creator and says, look, not only do I need the interpretation of the dream, I need the dream. And then he dreams, and then he's got to have the courage to go stand before the man who is threatened to kill everybody that can't tell him what's going on. Here's what you dreamt, and here's what it meant. I'm sorry, that takes courage. And then to hear the king say, that's exactly what happened. And oh, by the way, he was made head over the whole province of Babylon. That takes courage. When Esther is told, you have come into the kingdom for such a time as this, get everybody to fast, and in 3 days I'm going to go stand before the king, and if I perish, I perish. That takes courage. It's one thing to know God can do these things. It's another thing to walk into a situation like that and wonder if he's going to do this. What was it that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego said? We know that our God is able to deliver us from your hand, but if not, we still won't bow down. That takes courage. And Nebuchadnezzar didn't melt when they said these things to him. He had the fire ramped up. They bound them and threw them into the pit. That took courage. But that courage was rewarded when they got into that pit to find that the fourth man was already there waiting on them. All right, so again, I feel like I'm just kind of rambling all over the place here. But here's what I'm getting at. I've shared with you in times past with this congregation, in my heart, I know Beth feels the same way. You are precious to us because we see God doing something very, very special here. And if you're part of this congregation, I hope you understand and realize just how blessed you are that the Creator has put this together for you. You are an oasis, all right? But that didn't just happen. That was because people, leaders, families made a decision that we are going to establish boundaries and borders. Not arbitrary boundaries, mind you, but boundaries that are based on this book right here. We're going to establish these boundaries, and we're going to work within those boundaries. We're going to guard and defend this garden that the Creator has planted for us here. And by the way, somebody like me that passes by every now and then sees the fruit of that garden, how abundant it is, and how you can come in here and freely eat of all that the Creator has provided for you. But there were costs involved. Someone had to do the work. Someone had to be willing to fight and defend. And the enemy goes away for a little while, but not for all time. He's going to come back. And he keeps coming back. And I've seen that. And I've witnessed that. Beth and I have also, you know, seen that in our own lives. In fact, we've kind of come to the point of believing that most of the conflict that we have, and most of the warfare we have, is because we decided to establish boundaries and not move them to accommodate everybody else. And then people, family, friends, neighbors, how dare you not move your boundaries to accommodate me? That's their attitude. And so we've had to fight, we've had to defend. I know that you have to. If you think about it, the people you war against most of the time is not Planned Parenthood. It's not the Freedom From Religion Foundation. It's not Code Pink. It's not the ACLU. That's not who you end up fighting most of the time. Who is it? It's family. It's friends. It's neighbors. It's co-workers. It's all these people. But that's prep work for something else that's coming. Because something is coming. I won't pretend to know when. I won't pretend to know exactly what. But I know that I know that I know that something is coming. And you have been preparing for it. We have been preparing for it. He's been preparing his people at large for it. Because you see, whether you're in the king's palace or the king's prison, if you've been faithful, eventually the call comes. Because the world and their leaders and all the governments and all the institutions and organizations are going to one day be faced with things they don't know what the answer is. And guess what? God will have his man. He will have his woman. He will have his people. He will have that congregation who are in the right place at the right time, even though it didn't seem like they were in the right place in the right time. It seemed like they were in the wrong place at the wrong time. The call comes. And you step into that which you've been created to do. You've been created to perform. Read.
I will bend Judah as my bow. I will fill the bow with Ephraim, and I will stir up your sons, O Zion, against your sons, O Greece, and I will make you a warrior's sword.
I just recently witnessed something. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail here, but I was witness to something that really made a big impression upon me. Please help me to say this the right way, Father. Something that really caused me to go back to God and say, you know what, I was wrong. And I want you to forgive me. For a while, my attitude had been, as far as things that were going on in this country, to some degree had been, you know, bad stuff's going to happen. We just got to be prepared to do the work of the Lord and, you know, all this other stuff. You know, we can't really control all these other things. And while I understand what the book describes, that it's going to be a time unlike anything the world has seen, I allowed some of that thinking to cause me to quit defending. Just kind of focusing on the work, but not really doing the defending part or the guarding part. Does that make sense to you? And I had to go back and say, Father, I was wrong and I'm sorry. Please forgive me. And so I witnessed something here a few weeks ago, and it really left a big impression upon me, and that's this. That God can use anybody he wants to. And he has put certain gifts and talents and strengths in people that, frankly, looking at them, on the surface, I don't see, why would you use somebody like this? And I'm talking about the president, if you hadn't picked up on that. I mean, because when it comes to virtue and, you know, modesty and humility and things like this, not his strong suit. But here's something I witnessed. The man is a fighter. I really hope I'm not speaking out of turn here, but I'm going to make a point. The man is a fighter. And I was just overcome with, God, you use somebody like this to fight on my behalf. He told a group of people, and I'll paraphrase, he says, "You right now, you have a voice in the White House." Now, he's talking to believers. He's talking to a group of believers, and he's talking to some Jewish people, too. He says, "You have a voice in the White House right now." He said, "But you better find yours." You know what he's saying? Those people out there that want same-sex marriage and all these other things that's being pushed down our throats every day, they're fighting. They don't stop. They're always scheming. They're always plotting. I mean, you go read Psalm 2. Why do the nations rage and plot a vain thing? The kings of the earth they array themselves and they take counsel against God and against his anointed. And what do they want to do? They want to break his bonds and cast away their cords. They want to disregard every boundary, every border that the Creator has established. That's what's going on right now. And it just really just kind of overwhelming. Here's a man and his, you know, people in his administration. And I'm not here to be an advocate for any person, party, or philosophy. Okay? I'm just coming to realize some things that maybe God's trying to get across to us. And that this guy fights every day against people who are accusing him of stuff every day. And some of the stuff he's been accused of, I don't know if he did or didn't. I don't know. I really don't. But what I do see is someone who's, well, Ronald Reagan didn't move the embassy to Jerusalem. This guy did. All right, so my point is this. If God can use that man, and he fights, and he goes out and he wages war every day, then why can't we, who are full of the Spirit of God, who know what this word says, we need to raise our voice, not to, you know, promote any political position, not to promote any political philosophy, that's right, but to contend for the kingdom of heaven, seek first his righteousness, and all these other things that we worried about will be given to us. But maybe that's what's going on here, folks. Maybe we are reliving the story of Hanukkah. Maybe the Greeks are saying, you can't worship on the Sabbath. You can't do this. You can't do that. You can't say that. You can't say that because that'll offend the LGBTQ, ABCD, EFG group of people. You can't say that because that's going to offend the transgender people who wake up one day and they were born female, but now today they think they're a male. And they get married to another male. And then they think they're a dog. And they're led around on a leash in a dog park. And no, I'm not making that up. That actually is happening right now. California, go figure. But, when people are doing all this craziness, and that is considered to be normal, that's considered to be okay. But for me to stand up and quote from this book, well, that's offensive. I guess what I'm trying to say is we better learn to be offensive. We need to take the sword of the Spirit and go on offense because we've been sitting around too long on our backside on defense. We need to defend those things that have been entrusted to us. Quit allowing the enemy to dictate terms. I'm having my Popeye moment. I'm having my Popeye moment. And I think a lot of us are having our Popeye moment. We've had all we can take. We're not going to take anymore. And maybe God has just had to orchestrate things in such a way to make this point to us. I'll share this one last little thing with you and I'll hush. I do apologize if I've rambled this morning. But in this event that Beth and I were at, there were two Orthodox rabbis, and one of them was formerly from the Ukraine, and he gets up right before the end of this event, and he says words to this effect. He says, we're coming up in the season of Hanukkah, and he says, the season of Hanukkah occurs in a time of darkness. And he says, this nation and this world is in a time of unprecedented darkness. And he says, but we have the promise of the season and the festival of light. And he said, so you Christians, I want you to understand this. We weren't going to get into the messianic thing with him at this, but anyway, or the Hebrew roots thing or whatever. But he says, you Christians, he says, you need to realize something, that Hanukkah is not just a Jewish holiday. He said, Hanukkah is just as much for you as Christians as it is for us as Jews, and that we as Jews and Christians need to come together and be the light in the darkness. And I'm standing off to the edge of the stage. Now, maybe he meant politically, you know, I don't think so. But what I was hearing him say was, we need to come together and be the light that we're supposed to be. Which is, if you think about it, Joseph is in the prison house. And why is he called forth to stand before Pharaoh? It's not so Egypt can be great again. It's so that God could save Israel. That's what it was all about. So, you know, when I talk about fighting and standing up for what God has entrusted to us, please understand that, you know, we have our ideas and we have our agendas and we have our opinions. But Joseph wasn't called to stand before Pharaoh so that Egypt could endure famine as much as it was that the right man would be in the right place at the right time so that all Israel might be saved. That was the purpose behind it. And so it is today. The reason that we are to fight and to defend these things that God has entrusted to us, because in some way, somehow, and at some time, it will play a role in all Israel being saved. It will play a role in Joseph is standing there, his brethren are before him, they do not recognize who he is, and Judah has to step forward and demonstrate that he loves his father just as much as Joseph does. That he is willing to lay down his life on behalf of Rachel's son so that his father would not have to grieve. And that's when Joseph says, you know, he loves my father just as much as I love my father. And those two join together and become one. That was what it was all about. That remains what it's all about. And so God took me and Beth to this place to hear this Orthodox rabbi from the Ukraine say, talking about Hanukkah now, that this is as much for you as believers in, he said, Jesus. This is as much for you as believers in Yeshua as it is for us Jews. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. So I'll close with this. We do know that it's as much for us, even more so for us, quite frankly, because we understand that he's the light of the world. But then he turns right around and says to us that you are the light of the world. And so you think about that menorah that gives light, that is not supposed to be hidden under a bed or a bushel, but supposed to be placed out there for everybody to see. You think about that, that is the light, because he is the light, but it requires something. It requires for there to be fuel, whether it's oil or a candle. And that fuel has to be there and be willing to be consumed that there might be light. That's us. That's how we're light. Because we have to be willing for all of this, that what we want, what we desire, what we would rather it be, we have to allow that to all be consumed so that we in our lives, because he's in our lives, produces that light. In fact, nobody really thinks about the fuel when they're looking at the light, do they? The focus is on the light. So the focus can't be on me, can't be on you. It has to be on him and his purposes. The focus isn't on Joseph or Daniel. The focus is on how God used people like that to produce his purposes in the earth, to bring light into a dark world. That's what it's supposed to be about. This isn't about a president or a Congress or even a place called the United States. This is about his people, wherever they're at, wherever he's put them, preparing them for what he has placed them on this earth to do. And so if I might put it this way, there's that one shamash, that one attendant candle that is the source of light. And each night, everybody gets their turn to be light. Your turn's coming. My turn's coming. Those things that we've been prepared for, those things that we've been equipped for, those things that we've been called to do, your day's coming. Your summons is coming. The call is coming. Come out of the prison house. Come forward. I need some help. And the time will come that each and every one of us, individually and collectively, will be placed in a position to be light because we're willing to be consumed. My hope and my prayer is that one day we all get to hear him say, "You didn't leave anything undone that was given to you."